Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History of Ancient Egypt, Pyramids, Pharaohs, Gods, the Nile. We've got it all on this podcast. We've decided to go a bit bonkers. We decided to go crazy. We are going to do the whole thing from A to Z, from Dynasty 1 to Dynasty 31. In fact, we're going to go before, we're going to go Dynasty minus 1, and we're going to go beyond 31 as well. So you're going to get the whole thing here. The reason we're doing this, I'll tell you. We just published a book, History Hit Miscellany, available in all good bookshops. The sections on ancient Egypt are the ones that have been most widely shared and fed back on. People out there are fascinated by ancient Egypt. So go and grab the book. It makes a great Christmas present. But in the meantime, here is an episode of the podcast all about ancient Egypt. It's kind of everything you need to know. We decide to pack into one glorious podcast episode the whole history of ancient Egypt. And there's very few people can do that properly. And one of them is Dr. Campbell Price. He is head of Egypt and Sudan at the Manchester Museum, the most wonderful museum. You've got to go and check it out. And he offered a few months ago to take me on a wild ride through the entire history of ancient Egypt. And I held him to that promise. And here he is. This is the rise, the full rise and final fall of the pharaonic Egypt. Enjoy.
Atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima.
God save the king.
No black-white unity till there is first some black unity.
Never to go to war with one another again.
And liftoff, and the shuttle has cleared the tower.
Campbell, great to have you on the podcast.
Hi again, Dan. Great to be on.
Well, the trouble is I'm going to work you hard today because you're so brilliant. I've had too many questions every time I meet you, and I thought we'd just do a big look at the whole thing.
Okay.
I need to get my... Because we did a podcast the other day on Babylon, and that was interesting, and I've realised there's such an interest in the pre-classical cultures, the ancient Near East. And I want to situate, I need to get Egypt sorted in my mind compared to what's going on in the Fertile Crescent. So is the First Dynasty important? Like, what happens before the First Dynasty? What's going on in Egypt?
Well, I think the problem, Dan, is Egyptologists tell ourselves things that make Egyptology seem more important.
Oh.
So if we start at the beginning, so Dynasty 1, a major question in Egyptology is, what relationship does Egypt have with Mesopotamia? Who's, you know, everyone wants to be first with writing or royal imagery or, you know, whatever. The single thing, if you ask most Egyptologists, what is the first monumental thing? They would probably say the Narmer palette, which you've seen in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo.
Have I?
It is a sizable, like the size, about almost a meter tall, supersized version of a makeup palette where you grind pigment to apply to the face.
Okay.
So this is ostensibly a historical scene where you see the king of the south of Egypt beating up the king of the north of Egypt. And so this gives us the myth, the narrative, the historical reality of Egypt being unified.
Okay.
So we're pretty sure that the Egyptians told themselves this story, but it's really very convenient for an Egyptologist that this image just on its own explains the origin, the genesis of Egyptian civilization.
Okay, so you guys can go, there you go, there was a north and a south, they conquered it, and now we can get into Dynasty 1.
Yeah, okay. Start of Dynasty 1.
Okay, and so before that, there would have been cultures, societies living up and down the Nile, very fertile.
Well, I mean, I think if you visited Egypt 5,000 years ago, because we're talking about the origin of the pharaonic state, I don't like the word state because, you know, we have an idea of a modern state. It wasn't like that. But there is, centuries before Narmer, we know archaeologically, people are making pots with the same decoration in the north and the delta as they are in the south. So there's a communication going on. So probably, and you just suggested it, they kind of coalesce these groups around the very fertile river and the riverbanks, and they are doing farming, and then small groups become bigger, towns become bigger, and then people
In charge says, carve up that rock.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or go and fight the town next door.
Or let's do both at the same time. Okay, and what date is that?
So this is roughly 3000 BC.
Right, 3000 BC. And what's going on in the Fertile Crescent? Sort of.
There's something equivalent happening. They use things like, there are little motifs which appear on the Narmer palette, you know, floral motifs. Ooh, or which images of a griffin, like with intertwining, two griffins with intertwining necks.
Which you see in what we now call the Middle East as well. Yeah. Interesting.
So, you know, an Egyptian, modern Egyptian might say, oh, well, we invented it. And a modern Iraqi might say, but we invented it. And it's the jury's out. The thing about the Narmer palette is Egyptologists have used it to explain a single historic event. And I'm deeply skeptical of that.
Yeah, because these cultures could have been fighting each other up and down the Nile.
Oh, yeah.
And constantly. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But we have the Narmer palette.
Yes.
And around that time, we get Dynasty One.
Yes.
We?
He kicks off Dynasty One, right. Pretty much.
Who's he?
He is Narmer, King Narmer.
Okay, so Narmer kicks off Dynasty One.
Yeah, so his name means fighting catfish.
Okay.
So you don't want to mess with him.
Okay, I thought like, I was with you, there was a journey. I was like, fighting cat, cool. Fighting catfish?
Yeah.
Not quite as cool. But because of the survival of that, we kind of, that's why we date Dynasty One, but there could have been other Narmers a little bit further back.
Yes, so we begin with the very convenient Dynasty One and start the counting of the dynasties up to the Ptolemies.
Yeah.
But then other evidence pops up for people like this guy called Scorpion.
Oh, no. So you have to have dynasty like minus one.
Yeah,
minus
zero.
Two.
Dynasty zero.
Okay.
So, and dynasty zero is quite a flexible concept.
Yeah, that is.
So it's not Dwayne The Rock Johnson, although that the story of Scorpion did, I think, in some way.
Oh,
it's by
okay.
the Hollywood movie.
Okay, so, so we're going to go with Narmer.
Yes, Narmer.
And so he's the person we've chosen in a way. We've perhaps slightly arbitrarily decided is going to be the founding father of ancient Egypt.
Yes.
Okay.
And to some extent, the ancient Egyptians themselves forget about Narmer. And then he and possibly one of his successors, a guy called Hor-Aha, whose name means literally the fighter.
A better name.
So, you know, we've got a bit of a military sense.
We're getting a sense of what these guys were about.
Yeah. These guys coalesce into one kind of mythic figure called Menes. And Menes means the founder.
Oh, interesting.
So is it just chance that someone called the founder kicks things off? Probably
but
not.
But we're not a million miles out then by locating the beginning of the pharaonic project as being at Narmer. I mean, maybe a few generations out, but the Egyptians thought it was about then as well. Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so then when do we get pyramids? Because they're early on, aren't they?
They're early. And it's funny because when you say, you know, Cleopatra lived closer in time to us than to the pyramids.
I know, it's wild.
That is giving you the overall sweep of pharaonic Egypt is a hell of a long time. The pyramids, you're right, are early doors. So the first pyramid is Dynasty 3. So we're only quite early in the numbering. And that's a guy called Djoser. And he, or maybe his putative architect, a guy called Imhotep, who's probably just a high official and not actually an architect sitting with blueprints. Together, they come up with this, the first major stone building in the world, the Step Pyramid, which has got six massive limestone structures like a wedding cake. And that's it then for about the next 1,000 years, there is pyramid building. And they only stop building pyramids when there's a sense of it's a massive billboard. Rob me.
Please rob this.
So Djoser, sometime around 2800, is doing pyramids.
But when you go to that Step Pyramid today and you just think, as you say, it's the first monumental structure on this earth.
On the planet.
Wild.
Yeah.
So exciting.
The thing I like about the Step Pyramid, if you look at even Second World War reconnaissance pictures, it looks like it's in the middle of the desert.
Yeah.
And it's not now. It's been cleared. If you visited recently, it's been cleared. So you can visit it, and there's a nice pathway, and it's part of a whole complex, which was a kind of afterlife palace for king. So people say pyramid, and you imagine pointy things in the middle of the desert. Well, A, it's not in the middle of the desert, and B, it's not really a pointy thing by that point because they've not developed the smooth-sided.
It's
true
quite
pyramid.
Lush around there, I remember. Yeah. Well, perhaps that's more modern, but this canal, there's irrigated. There's just on the edge of, yeah.
The Nile's moved a bit. You know, the course has fluctuated. But that's an important point. Pyramids and tombs were always meant to be close to fields where offerings were going to come from. You don't want to be in the middle of a desert not being given bread and beer and wine and onions.
Onions. So we get the wonderful step pyramids. Then when do you get the straight-sided pyramids, the flat ones at Giza?
So that's a few generations later, maybe just over 100 years later. A guy, the real unsung hero of pyramid construction is not King Khufu, who builds the Great Pyramid. It's his dad. So Khufu's dad is called Sneferu, and he is responsible for two, probably three pyramids. So in terms of pyramid volume, he is the biggest pyramid builder in the history of Egypt and indeed the world. So he experiments in a sense. He fills in the sides of a step pyramid. That kind of falls a bit to rack and ruin. But then he tries again with a smooth-sided pyramid. It doesn't quite work. Possibly he's intending it to look like a very squat obelisk. But that's another story. And then he perfects the true pyramid, what we call the Red Pyramid. And that looks like something out of a Hollywood movie.
Wow. And I mean, just the number of people, the resources that deploy. What's that tell us about what we're now calling the Old Kingdom? I mean, lots of people?
Potentially lots of people. You're right. So we're in the Old Kingdom, this beginning of this conventional division of time by Egyptologists. So the Old Kingdom is, as most of the rest of Pharaonic time, was a land of farmers. So remember, there's the annual flood. So when the Nile burst its banks in the summer, it doesn't happen now because of the Aswan High Dam.
Sadly.
But when it burst its banks for a few months, your fields are under water. So a lot of people would be called up in a kind of corvée.
Nothing else to do.
You've got nothing else to do. Why not come to the Royal Pyramid site, the Royal Building Project, and the king will pay for you. So you'll be looked after, you'll have doctors, you'll have food, you'll have drink, you'll have entertainment, you'll have somewhere to stay, and you can go back and brag to your families about, for a few months I was, you know, blocks.
You've built a building that would be astonishing even now if it was built.
Sure.
And we're used to mad people building mad things in Qatar. But like, even now, if you built a pyramid, you'd be like, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So what would it be like 5,000 years ago?
It would be, it would be worth talking about for sure. And so often, Dan, you know, we look at ancient Egypt through the experience of more recent history, colonialism, our modern ideas of politics and dictatorship. And we think, either the kings were splendid godlike beings or they were tyrannical, dreadful pieces of work. And I think that the truth is probably in between. So, you know, if you're a farmer in the south of Egypt and you go up to the building project near what is now Cairo, and you spend a few months, a year there, the fact you did it may have been such an honour. Even just to be involved in the project may have conferred some magical, religious, you know, afterlife possibilities on you that maybe other people wouldn't get. So, yes, it would be hard work, I'm not denying. Building a pyramid of 2.5 million blocks is hard, and we don't really know how they did it, but it was hard work. And I think being part of the team would be fun because we've got the names of some of the gangs. So you have names like Friends of Khufu or Drunkards of Khufu.
Yeah, that's interesting.
You know, it could have been a laugh.
There's a vibe there. Yeah. I know I get you in trouble whenever I ask you this, but because when you say you don't exactly know how they built it, that's true, but that does not mean that aliens built it, folks. But that, just for the audience, like, you don't act, in terms of engineering and construction, we don't know how they did it, do we?
Yeah, for the record, no one seriously believes it was alien extraterrestrial life forms. It was Egyptian people working hard, using boats. So I mentioned the flood.
You had me at boats. Exactly.
So there's a quarry. You can see it from the Giza Plateau. There's a quarry on the other side of the river on the eastern bank of the Nile. When the flood rises, you take your boat. And you right up there at the quarry, and then you float it over right up pretty much to the pyramid site. And gosh, not 20 years ago, there was an incredible find made by an Egyptian-French mission on the Red Sea coast of basically the diary of one of the guys that had been floating the blocks. So it's, you know, people think historical discoveries, we're never going to find an account of how they built the pyramids. This was as close as we could get. So a guy called Merer was in charge of getting blocks in this kind of rota up onto the pyramid, probably near the end of construction based on the date of the king's reign. But that gives you an insight into the day-to-day. How do you build a pyramid? You float blocks up to the site and you probably use a ramp to get them up and then, into place.
As well, the pyramid, for me, the highlight of the pyramids is actually not the pyramids, but is the ship. Is the boat.
Oh, the boat. I honestly, the very boat.
I burst into tears when I saw that. It was the most beautiful thing as a boat person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've got these pyramids being built. We've got an old kingdom. Geographical extent, are we moving into Libya with the Middle East? Because North Mediterranean, obviously.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To the south, you've got Sudan. Is it stretching up the Nile a bit?
So the Egyptians of the old kingdom are well aware of what they called Nubia. So this area to the south of Egypt, what we would now call southern modern Egypt, the north of modern Sudan. But they have relationships with the peoples to the west, what people we would call Libyans.
Yeah.
So later in the Old Kingdom, Dynasty 5, Dynasty 6, you get officials bragging about having gone on trading expeditions. They're not claiming that as an empire.
Okay.
Egypt is Egypt. Egypt is the Nile Valley down to Aswan, basically.
Okay.
And that's it.
Right.
And pretty much that continues for most of Pharaonic history.
Really? Okay. Yeah. So when they do mess about into what is now Syria, Palestine, or Libya, it's not a sense like a Roman or a British imperial sense of trying to make the world Rome.
No.
Or, okay.
It's a foray.
It's a
they
foray.
They want stuff.
And potentially clientism.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when you look on a tomb chapel wall in the New Kingdom and you see all these guys bringing, you know, golden rings to the Pharaoh's court, it looks a lot like tribute. And we use words like viceroy and Durbar and these very British colonial terms. Actually, I think you're right. There would be more of a sense of exchange. There would be raids. There would be going and grabbing stuff because the Egyptians, in some sense, in some ways, at some times were more powerful. But then sometimes the non-Egyptians pushed back.
But you do have this quite useful fact, don't you, of pretty extreme desert in Sinai, so to the east. Mm. Pretty extreme desert, the Western Desert, Mediterranean to the north. So there's a protection there, nature's protection. Okay, so we're moving through the pyramid builders. The Old Kingdom, you say they're building for how long did you say they're building pyramids?
In total, so the Step Pyramid of Djoser is like the bookended by one in the late Middle Kingdom, and between the two of them is about 1,000 years.
Okay, 1,000 years. Wow. Okay, but so the Old Kingdom, why does the Old Kingdom come to an end? What's he's rolling his eyes, folks. Okay, in short, we can make it a very short process.
Right, there's a complex socioeconomic reason. Basically, the power, which previously, in the time of the pyramids, Dynasty 4, is with the royal family, pretty much. Power expands, number of officials expand. They take themselves off, it seems, to the regions of Egypt. Mm. And then the central authority of the king weakens somewhat, and it doesn't help the last
old story.
The last king of the Old Kingdom proper, Pepi II, lives to be possibly nearly 100 years old. So, you know, that creates dynastic uncertainty.
Okay, so this is actually an example of a long-lived king causing instability by the length of his reign.
Yes.
Interesting. Mm. And there's what, your basic common and garden, bit of civil war, bit of collapse.
There are definitely factions. There's Egypt. This is something really important that people often forget. Egypt today in the ancient world was, and still is, regional. It is like many places, it has a strong set of regional identities. In the record, sometimes the king seems to be all powerful.
Definitely.
And he is telling everyone in the regions what to do. That situation becomes more transparent probably by what we call the first intermediate period, when that power of the king, the monarchy in Memphis, near modern Cairo, slips. And so the local rulers, the nomarchs, as we call them, which seems rather unfair, the local governors, they take back control, if you like.
and I hate to do this, but not unlike Chinese history, where you get these strong kind of dynastic mm-hmm. periods, and then you get these quite radical interregnums and quite creative, quite destructive, and then something else emerges.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, something else comes out of that. The interesting thing about the first intermediate period is we have archaeological evidence for some kind of change in the conception of the elite. Elites become more kingly. It's not like, you know, day one, we're in the first intermediate period, everyone change your pottery.
No.
Change your crockery. It's not like that. But in later periods in the Middle Kingdom, those Middle Kingdom Egyptians are looking back, casting the so-called first intermediate period as a time of chaos, out of which the great and the just and the enlightened kings of the Middle Kingdom have come.
Yeah. We saved you from...
Yes.
So actually, if you were in the intermediate period, you might be thinking, life's all right.
Yeah.
I'm having a great old time.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, that's interesting.
Listen to Dan Snow's history. Talk about ancient Egypt. The whole lot of it. More coming up.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm looking for answers to the big questions about every aspect of life in the early modern period. Like, how did the memory of Anne Boleyn continue to influence the court of her daughter, Elizabeth I? How were fairies brought to life on the Elizabethan stage? And how did the arrival of male-only doctors threaten the lives of women? In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now and follow me on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when using messaging apps, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage, add unlimited photos and videos, and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AURAframes.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. How long would that intermediate period be?
A couple of hundred years.
Yeah, which
not
is
not long.
Well, not long, except it's the time between the Battle of Trafalgar and today.
Okay.
I mean, it's crazy, isn't it? It's so
in the sweep of Egyptian pharaonic history.
A lot can happen in a couple hundred years, right?
True.
That's amazing. So, does the Middle Kingdom begin with a bang? Is there a founder, a more identifiable founder, who says, don't worry, we're back in the game, here's a Middle Kingdom?
Yes. Okay. So the person recognised as the kind of second Narma, the reunifier, is a guy called Montuhotep Nebhepet Re.
Right.
Trips off the tongue.
It does.
And he comes from the south again. So Narma's a southerner who kind of takes over the north. So The hometown of our friend Montuhotep is a little known place called Thebes.
Okay.
Modern Luxor. And that is what absolutely pins that place to the map. And that is now why Luxor is such an incredible open-air museum, is because Montuhotep's family, once they conquered the rest of Egypt, essentially, went back to honour their local god, Amun.
And is he reaching back to the old kingdom for its symbols, for its language, to boost the dignity of his own pharaonic rule?
I think actually Montuhotep II, Nebhepet Re, is actually more radical than that.
Okay.
He does some kind of weird new things. It's later kings who follow him, who are maybe slightly less sure of their own position. They look back to the past and use ancient symbols and
they're still building the odd pyramid.
And they are still building pyramids.
Right.
We're not quite sure whether Montuhotep builds a pyramid himself, possibly, but he's got some very innovative ideas about architecture.
Do we know where Montuhotep's buried?
At Thebes, yes. So he creates a temple tomb structure near, right next to, in fact, although he doesn't realise it, the female pharaoh Hatshepsut's temple. So that's why that area is very sacred, Deir el-Bahri.
Deir el-Bahri, but we found his, have we?
We've not found his body. His body has never been found.
Of course.
But we've found his wives. And he's got quite a harem going on there of, I hate to say harem. He has got a group of elite women who are buried there.
Yeah.
Who are priestesses of Hathor and who are, you know, very significant ladies.
It's so interesting when we talk about this, and we said this before to each other, like, so there's moments of great familiarity with this history because there's moments of ambition and conquest and desire and belief. But then there's moments of complete confusion and obscurity. Like, what is their relationship with him and with each other, and what are they doing there? Isn't it wonderful?
Because
it's tantalizing.
It's tantalizing, and you've got to remember, nothing was written for a modern historian. The ancient Egyptian artisan is not writing that text for you or I to say, aha, this is the historical reality. Because historical reality was not, of course, to the people who lived through certain times, it was important, but recording it didn't obey the rules of the gods.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
The gods want perfection. And if you want to be perfect for eternity, you don't represent things as they are.
Oh, interesting. Like Instagram.
Yes, okay, something like that.
So you've got the Middle Kingdom.
Yes.
Do you get a female pharaoh in the Middle Kingdom?
You do. So several very powerful war leaders, I guess you could say. So Egypt's military ambitions expand out of Egypt in Dynasty 12. So we've now got to number 12 in the dynasty counting system. So we're talking maybe 1900 to 1700 BC.
Okay.
By this point, and that finishes with the last great pyramid complex, that of Amenemhat III, and his is based on Djoser's pyramid complex. That's why I say they're bookending pyramid construction. So after Amenemhat III snuffs it, eventually his daughter becomes pharaoh, and she is the pharaoh. She is a woman.
Pharaoh regnant.
And she is ruling, not married to another pharaoh. She's doing it on her own.
Wow. Cool. And this military ambition, again, it's raids?
It's so it's going north, it's going west, it's going south. Right. Actually, in Manchester Museum, where I work, there's a great account of a chap called Sobek Ku, who says he was a soldier under two of these 12th Dynasty kings, and he talks about taking hands. And he talks about, you know, raiding corpses on the battlefield and being rewarded for it by the king. So there's a real sense of pride. It's not just him, other soldiers boast about, I was in the following of the king on essentially a raid into the Levant.
Is it in a privileged position? Are they deciding how and when to use violence, or are there groups coming in from the Levant and raiding the Egyptians?
The evidence points towards the Egyptians doing it for themselves.
Wow. So that's a nice position to be in. You have a kind of this bastion defended by sea and desert, and then you occasionally decide you want to leave that space and...
But you mentioned bastions there. That's a good point at which to mention these incredible fortresses.
Ooh.
And they're building them down towards Nubia, so in the south towards Sudan.
Yeah, because Nubia is the weak, because they can just hop on a boat and come down river, right? So that feels vulnerable.
In a sense, but there are cataracts in the river,
oh,
you know, these
are
massive boulders.
Okay.
But because of the Aswan High Dam being raised in the 1960s, a lot of these sites are flooded now under Lake Nasser. But the amount of masonry, I say masonry, mud brick architecture that is lost, that has dissolved like an Alka-Seltzer, I mean, puts the pyramids to shame. So you get this sense of stone building in the Old Kingdom, but in the Middle Kingdom, those pyramids, the cores of them are made of mud bricks. And then these massive flipping fortresses built to the south, maybe to just impress the Nubians, maybe to regulate trade, or maybe because there was a real threat.
Yeah, exactly.
Where they had to say, okay, we're going to have to keep an eye on the Nile traffic.
Interesting. And Middle runs from, let's just quickly get the dates, you said 1900?
Right, 1900, say, to 1600, 1650.
Okay, so Middle, only 300 years or so.
Classical age, you know, great works of art, great works of jewellery.
I'm not demeaning it.
Literature. But three or so centuries.
And what happens at the end of the Middles?
Well, a bit more decentralisation, but then there is an influx of a non-Egyptian group.
Right.
The Hyksos.
Famous Hyksos.
And they bring, on balance, it seems likely that they bring horses, which the Egyptians haven't encountered before.
Interesting. The old horse. Not the last time it will inflict a catastrophic defeat on a mighty civilization. Mm-hmm. So they're coming from, we think, probably coming from the east.
Yes. Yeah. So up towards what's now modern Turkey.
Yeah.
So they're coming down. They're not controlling all of Egypt. Egypt, in pockets, has Egyptian governance. But there's a great text where one king is complaining about hearing hippos in the distance, and this is all a metaphor for non-Egyptian control of Egypt. So ultimately, this period is called the Second Intermediate Period.
And you get the Hyksos there. It's a crucible of conquerors, that kind of Central Asian steppe horse. You know, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
Because Egypt, of course, is so fertile. It's such great Arab land. If Egypt doesn't have a central power to defend itself, maybe people just come along and think, actually, we'd rather graze our herds here, please, thanks.
Why would you not want to be there? So the Hyksos, but then re-establishment of indigenous rule.
Yes, and so this is the second reunification under another Theban family. So the Thebans are doing it yet again, modern Luxor. A chap called Kamose, his brother, son, male relative, Ahmose, they boot out the Hyksos and establish the glorious new kingdom, golden age of ancient Egypt, Dynasty 18.
And 18, it was the absolute ballers, right? You've got one, like one after the other, just world class.
Yeah, I mean, really some impressive, really impressive warriors, impressive culture champions, impressive god kings.
So Ahmose the first.
Oh, well, now we think he's Ahmose the second.
Okay.
Because we found another Ahmose.
Okay, right. But we got Thutmosis there, haven't we?
Yes, the four kings called Thutmosis.
Yeah. And then we got Amenhotep.
Mm-hmm.
The builder.
Four of them.
Which one's the builder?
Well, my favourite Amenhotep is actually Amenhotep the second, because he is a real kind of playboy prince who becomes a bit of a nasty piece of work when he's the king. He's got a love of horses, so by this point, the military have absorbed that new technology. So Amenhotep II, we've got a chariot harness finial at Manchester Museum, which may have come from his chariot with his name on it. And it says, fear of him is throughout the lands. Mm-mm. So it's one of these kind of threatening statements. He boasts about firing arrows from his chariot into a copper target. Ooh. So he's a mean piece of work.
And it's his son, Amenhotep III.
No, his grandson is Amenhotep III.
Is he the one described as the builder?
Yeah, he's a big builder.
Yeah, he builds a lot, right, exactly.
Colossi of Memnon.
That's right.
Are just a fragment of this massive kind of counterpoint to Karnak. So Karnak's on the east, Amenhotep III builds this ginormous mansion of millions of years. One of the most impressive aspects of which was over 1,000 stone statues of the goddess Sekhmet. So whether it's Turin, New York, Chatsworth House, if you've seen one of those, it came from that temple.
That's cool.
Of Amenhotep III.
And then you've also got the Hatshepsut in that dynasty.
How could we not mention Hatshepsut? So she is the co-ruler, the aunt, the stepmother of Thutmose III. So this is before Amenhotep III. And she rules very successfully as the female pharaoh of Egypt for 20 years.
Amazing. And her temple we know about, the El-Bahari, and it's beautiful, and images again of these expeditions quite far afield to get precious items and trade goods. And
yeah, I mean, it seems we have this impression, and again, we're looking through a very modern filter at this. It seems that she kind of eschews this idea of military conquest for trading, explicit trading with Punt, the land of Punt, which may be Horn of Africa somewhere, area, yeah. Eritrea maybe. And she has this incredible expedition that goes off for years and she doesn't know what's happened to them. You know, there's no live feed coming back about what's happened to this massive trading expedition. They build these ships on the Nile Valley, flat pack them, and take them across the desert, build them again on the Red Sea coast, and sail to Punt and bring her back lots of nice fancy things like panther skins and incense trees.
Very nice.
Yeah.
And that's all, and beautifully recorded on the walls of that temple as well.
Yes.
So her stepson is Thutmosis.
The Napoleon of ancient Egypt.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're grimacing there, but what's he Napoleonizing? Where's he carving out those conquests? Where's he going?
Napoleon is the Thutmose III of France, not the other way around.
Oh, yeah, sorry, of course.
But no, it's just a kind of a lazy comparison, because I think Thutmose III rules a long time. So he comes to the throne. His father dies, Thutmose II, that's the husband of Hatshepsut, female pharaoh, dies when Thutmose III is really young, like a toddler young.
Yeah. So that's why she takes over.
She steps in and there's much debate about this. So eventually she disappears from the scene, the historical scene, about 20 years later. Then he goes on to rule for another 30 years and he has lots of military expeditions. He builds lots. He makes a mark on his own. But I suspect rather than viewing Hatshepsut as a wicked stepmother, he views her as a role model. Mm. And her foreign sorties are viewed very positively, actually, by Thutmose III.
Well, he'd been wise to try and use her as an example. Then we get Amenhotep IV, who is Akhenaten.
Indeed.
And the whole move to Amarna and changing the religion.
That's
a whole separate thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tutankhamun's dad,
maybe his granddad, but this is the most unusual episode probably in pharaonic history. Akhenaten, well, changes his name for a start and then says, right, chaps, we're going to move the capital city to a God's forsaken part of Egypt, Middle Egypt. And he just does things very differently, looks very weird. He must be quite unpopular because he does like to show himself being surrounded pretty constantly by a military escort. So you get the sense that people are not entirely chuffed that he's changed the majority religion. But his revolution experiences a counter-revolution. Tutankhamun comes along and restores the worship of good old Amun, the god of Thebes.
So the god of Thebes has been restored. Then we are into the next few dynasties. They've got some Rameseses now, do we, coming into the story? They join the chat.
Yes, that's kind of Aravist, new kids on the block. Immediately following Tutankhamun, there's an older statesman, there's a general, military general, a guy called Horemheb. Neither of them have any children, so they bring on a chap called Rameses, and he has a son and a grandson living. So there's a dynasty already in waiting. And so that's Dynasty 19. Rameses II, wham bam, thank you, Ram, is, by any stretch of the imagination, he's a pretty mega Egyptian king. Rules for 66 years, over 100 children probably.
Wow.
He's a busy man. He builds lots, lots and lots and lots. And if you go to Egypt today, the royal name, the cartouche in the oval shape, you will encounter most is that of Usermatra Setip Inra, Rameses II.
And astonishing temples, Ramesseum, amazing. Mm-hmm. Fighting against people in the Levant?
Yes, right. Hittites. He's most well known for the Battle of Kadesh, which he fights when he's fairly young. And he says in his numerous accounts of this, that he finds himself alone and the other soldiers aren't fighting with him, and he has got to take on the might of this foreign army himself, although he's on foreign land at the time. So there's a real sense of reportage here. You get the sense there was an army scribe recording something of the military expedition.
New Kingdom comes to an end, is it with the Persian invasion?
Not so much the Persians, that's a little bit later. So Dynasty 19 comes to an end because, again, Ramesses had lived a long time. He's succeeded eventually by his 13th son, a guy called Merimptah, who's fairly old when he comes to the throne, you know, a child of an older ruler. And the following kings are a bit naff, to be frank. Then along comes a new dynasty, Ramesses III. He gets involved in some fairly threatening, he's repulsing foreign invasion from Libya, from the Sea Peoples, from various Confederate groups. So he, by some measure, is the last great Egyptian hero king. I think Ramesses III.
He's keeping the show on the road.
And
what date is he?
He's like the 1100s BC.
Yeah, the Greeks, unfortunately, are really stepping up at this point. Yeah. Troublesome.
Things are, in the Near East, in the Eastern Mediterranean in general, things are getting complicated. And so the new kingdom ends with Egypt internally facing some kind of socio-economic strife. There is a strike, the first recorded strike in human history. The guys who are building the king's tomb down their tools in the reign of Ramesses III. He's assassinated by one of his wives who wants to advance the case of her son. And the new kingdom ends in another decentralized situation in Egypt.
So then a few centuries of just sort of decentralization, and then the Persians, or what's
the Persians come along. There are Libyan kings.
Oh, there are Libyan kings then.
Who had been settled probably as part of the army, part of a kind of mercenary force in the army.
Taking on the guise of Egyptian pharaohs?
Yeah. Yes, the mantle of kingship is with them. The Nubian kings, for about a century, they're very successful, actually. They have interesting foreign relations. And then the Assyrians come along and they're pretty nasty. They sack Thebes. We've got an Assyrian helmet at Manchester Museum where it looks like an Egyptian soldier just knocked the helmet off the guy's head. And then eventually, the Persians come along and they rule as Dynasty 27. So they style themselves not very convincingly as Egyptian kings. You know, Darius, not that bothered about being an Egyptian king.
Xerxes, last Persian Egyptian king. Mm-hmm. So is Alexander the Great an Egyptian pharaoh? What dynasty is that?
Ah, so he kicks out the Persians. The Persians disappear. There's a moment of indigenous rule. Then the Persians come back and Alexander sweeps in, and either he's the invader or he's the liberator of Egypt.
Yeah.
And he is Dynasty 31, you could say, before the Ptolemies. And he sets up the Ptolemies.
One of his leading generals, Ptolemy, gets that bit of the empire when it all gets partitioned. And quite successful. I mean, generations of Ptolemies will rule Egypt. As Greeks, as light-skinned Greek rulers.
As Macedonian Greeks. Yeah. The family, of course, is Egyptian components.
Ruling
Egypt,
Okay. So they're not like a foreign ruling caste.
They are to an extent, because remember, they're based in Alexandria. They're not based in Memphis. They're trying to keep the Memphite or the indigenous priesthood on side, which is a job.
Yeah.
But they are probably speaking Greek and dressing like contemporary Hellenistic Macedonian Greeks.
Okay. Yeah. But doing some intermarrying,
trying to keep an eye on the temples. And it's funny, in the Ptolemaic period, we have more historical accounts for incestuous marriage, infighting, murder, scheming, revolts that probably happened before. We just don't know about them because the nature of the record.
And it all kind of comes down to Cleopatra, who attempts to steer a course through the internal politics of the Roman Empire, fails to do so in the end, and then Egypt becomes a Roman province.
Indeed. I mean, she's a canny politician to an extent, but ultimately, as you say, that game is lost, and Battle of Actium, she and Mark Antony die, and then Octavian sweeps in, and Egypt becomes, for a few centuries, part of the Roman Empire.
She styles herself as a pharaoh, so she's the last. The Roman emperors don't take on the symbol, the regalia of the pharaohs, do they? Or
they do to an extent in some temples. Okay. The thing about Cleopatra is she styles herself in true pharaonic fashion as a living goddess.
Okay.
And she follows her Ptolemaic forebears in that. But I just think, other than maybe Hadrian, the Roman emperors are not that bothered about Egypt.
Yeah.
I mean, Hadrian's an Egyptophile.
Hadrian loves the place.
He deifies his boyfriend, Antinous, and he ships lots of obelisks back to Rome. And that's why more standing obelisks can be found in Rome than in all of Egypt.
Wow. And also, my greatest ever trip, I've been to the quarry where Hadrian chopped the rock, the great granite quarry for the enormous pillars that are now on outside the Pantheon in Rome.
Oh.
And you can go to the desert of Egypt and you can see the pillars that have been they're working on them and put down tools and left them
Abandoned them.
Yeah.
Oh, I've not been there.
Oh, that's great.
Let's go.
Anyway, come on. The end of this conversation, I've worked out something where I've been in Egypt where you haven't been. That's a real buzz for me. Thank you so much. How can people, they should go and visit the Manchester Museum.
Absolutely.
Just reopened. I've been there recently.
You have.
Box office.
Hurtling towards a million visitors.
So cool. Congratulations. So,
yeah, thanks.
All the hard work's paid off. Good to see you, man.
Thank you.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.